My name is Medea Alatini, and I will be your host. So Dunche, ING, Medea, Uye, Shanka Jut Iche, and Huan Man Kayi Koche. So I'm from Kewaunee First Nation Territory, and I'm from the Crow Clan. And I am zooming in from the traditional territories of the Kwanlin Dun and the Ta'an Kwachan Council here in Whitehorse Yukon, or Kwanlin Yu. And my guest today is Dr. Raywat Dhiyanandan, and you are an associate professor at the University of Ottawa. And I'm going to give you a moment to introduce yourself.
Thank you. First, of course, I am zooming in from Ottawa, Ontario, which is unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe peoples. I, as you noted, I'm an epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of Ottawa. And that is my claim to fame at the moment. The past couple of years, I've been heavily involved in media and public commentary regarding all aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic. I don't consider myself a COVID researcher, even though I do some peripheral research in that area. I consider myself a communicator in public health, interpreting the science for media, the lay people, and other non-scientists.
Which is very much appreciated. So that's been, has it been right from the start of the pandemic? So over the past 2 years, and what really caused that shift to focus on public communication for you?
For me personally, my personal voyage has been, interesting. My spouse was pregnant when the pandemic was just starting, is our first child. And one night I did the math, sometime in late February of 2020, I think. And it was math that other epidemiologists who are more capable than I had done already. And I realized, oh my goodness, this is not going to end for years. And there's a very strong chance that my elderly parents might never see their first and only grandchild. They may die before that happens. And this terrified me. And my spouse found me in the fetal position the next morning. And I'm a joyful guy, a positive guy, because I realized something that most people hadn't realized yet, except for those who are in my field. And that is, this is not an endeavor for several weeks. This is a many years long ordeal. So I asked myself, what can I do? At some point, my child would ask me, Dad, you're an epidemiologist. What did you do with the great pandemic of 2020? I had to have an answer. And my answer was, well, because I'm not an infectious disease expert, even though I do have training in that area, my expertise, I think, is in communication. So I immediately wrote some articles. I wrote some blog posts, most prominently something called COVID-19, What's the End Game, which I explained what herd immunity is and what the challenges are for this disease. And at the time, my blog was getting, I don't know, 20 to 100 readers per week. That one got 500,000. And I realized, there is actually a thirst for commentary of this nature. And instantly, the phone started ringing, and the media hasn't stopped calling since, because there is a thirst and there's a shortage of trained people in public health sciences who are capable and willing to engage in the public discourse. And that, of course, has come at a personal cost as well.
And being able to not just sense, but alleviate the fears, because you are going through the same thing that many other Canadians or many other global citizens are going through, of having elderly parents and having young children, and being able to articulate what those risks are and how do you deal with those risks. I think that's a very important piece of your communication style.
It really is. And one of the things that worries me is the extent to which the next generation of scientists seem unwilling to engage in this job. And I can't blame them, because one of the things we've learned the last couple of years is the heated nature of this topic. It abuts other political issues like climate change and the ceding of Indigenous territories, for example. All these things are politically laden. And anytime a supposed expert has a public commentary on it, they come for you personally. What I'm hoping happens at the end of all this is we can re-examine the cracks in society, how we support the less fortunate, how we re-encapsulate the language and methods by which we communicate with the public, and also how to encourage another generation of public health communicators to take up this challenge.
And I think you hit the nail on the head there with that. Increasing or leveling the playing field, that piece of equity, it needs to be really threaded throughout the conversations that we have, because we're not all starting from the same place. And your dialogue is, you communicate in a style that is, it's heard by many, I think.
So very kind of you to say, but I mean, didn't mean to cut you off, I'm sorry. No. One of the things I've been saying for a while is pandemics have a way of exacerbating the existing cracks in society. I stole that line from somebody else. I've forgotten who, but it was such a prescient and perfect encapsulation of the challenges of global crises like that, that I jumped on it. And I've been saying it again and again and again, because it's true. And we saw it happen. Yeah. And these cracks in society are racial, they're gender-based, they're predominantly socioeconomic, and they're ideological. And what we didn't foresee was the extent to which some disingenuous, ill-meaning powers would deliberately exacerbate those cracks by pushing, you know, COVID misinformation, vaccine misinformation, trying to create division in society, when in fact there is not a great deal of division around these topics generally, but there's a perception of them. One thing I hope happens at the end of all this is we take the time to fix, or at least attempt to fix, these divisions, these cracks in society, so that we are not as susceptible to the next crisis. And the next crisis is coming, of course, as it always is.
I know. When we're one of the questions that I had lined up was, where do you think we are in this pandemic?
All right. You know what? I get that question every week. And, you know, I think, depends on what you mean by pandemic. There is the global declaration of pandemic. I think we're probably nearer to the end than to the beginning of the global declaration. And the reason for that is the deaths globally seem to be falling. And not just at a, because of the decline in the wave, this seems to be an overall declination in deaths, suggesting that the combination of population immunity and vaccination-based immunity, and maybe the seasonal aspects of the virus, have finally gotten to the point where the emergency is dwindling. So perhaps by the end of this year, next year, the pandemic would be declared over. It doesn't mean the crisis is over. The disease is not going away, and it's here for the duration of the human life existing on this planet, probably. Doesn't mean we're going to be terrified of it forever. It just means that it's just one more coronavirus we're going to have to deal with. Just like the other coronaviruses that we deal with right now, at one point in history, were global emergencies, but they're not anymore. That's the broad lens of looking at it. What you want to hear really is, how much longer are we going to hear about this in the news? And the answer is probably until the end of this year, but less and less as the weeks and months go on, unless another nasty new variant arises that that demonstrably and voluminously challenges our hard-won immunity. So it's possible.
Yeah. Are you seeing the shifts? I know we're hearing a bit about the BA4, BA5. Are you seeing that trend in Canada, or?
It's not something I've been paying that much attention to, given that this is not, you know, the focus of my research. It's happening. The good news, of course, is that every single variant so far responds to our vaccines, every single one. Less so than originally, but they do respond, and the ability of the vaccines to keep us out of the hospital remains very, very high, and to keep us out of the morgue remains extraordinarily high. So again, even as these new variants arise, the challenge to the overall mortality will diminish unless something absolutely new arises. So with these subvariants now becoming dominant, that's just par for the course, I think.
There's a question that we had about the surge in cases that we're seeing in China and those lockdowns, and that has a lot of repercussions, not just socially, but on North America with our supply chain, economically. What is the, I guess, why is China in such a serious lockdown right now when the rest of us are opening up?
A few reasons. First is that China really embraced the COVID zero mentality early on, as I think was appropriate, frankly. I personally think we should have approached COVID zero as a reality in 2020, there came a point where it wasn't going to happen. And right now, I think it's a pipe dream to consider COVID zero a possibility for us. But they still think it's possible. I don't think it is. The other reason, and that explains why they're big on the lockdown. They're trying to stamp it out entirely. The other thing is they used poor quality vaccines that we have. The mRNA vaccines are top notch. China was using their homegrown vaccines, which, you know, are good enough for some purposes, but don't have the same durability or robustness and efficaciousness that the mRNA ones have. And so even though late in the game, they upped their vaccination rate, it wasn't with as good of a vaccine that we do. As a result, there is a still a strong sense of susceptibility in that population. So the ability of the disease to penetrate deeply and to create crises in healthcare and mortality is higher than in us. So that combination of a desire to stamp out everything and add a susceptibility because of a lesser quality vaccine usage is what's causing this. I don't know what's going to happen. I suspect they're going to come to the realization where they cannot contain this thing and push for a more vigorous and updated vaccination strategy and re-enter the global community that way.
Yeah. How does that stretch to the rest of the global community with our mRNA vaccines being the premium quality ones? And are we sharing that globally?
Yeah, it's a good question. We are sharing it, but not to the extent that I think we could or should. The production capacity of mRNA vaccines is not as great as with the viral vector vaccines, which is what AstraZeneca uses and Sputnik V uses, for example. And the viral vector vaccines are more easily manufactured. They can be transported more easily. They can be stored more easily. They're probably the best bet to immunize the world. So I think AstraZeneca probably has a better impact on global immunity than the mRNA ones will. The mRNA ones are probably reserved for wealthy nations simply because of the cost and the ability to ship and store. The Chinese vaccines are not viral vector, to my knowledge. There are a older technology, an attenuated virus, or sometimes a kill virus, that tends to have less durable immunity. And they have shared their vaccine to a number of countries, good for them. Some other countries could not get access to these other quality vaccines. So if the question is, how does the limitations of the Chinese vaccines affect global immunity, it is a problem. But again, it's better than no vaccine at all. And some countries have no vaccine. I mean, we can talk about North Korea as well. I'm really concerned about North Korea, an almost entirely unvaccinated population, a poor quality healthcare system in which only the absolute wealthiest have access to any kind of healthcare at all, poor nutrition overall, therefore a high level of susceptibility. So I'm concerned that the disease will rip through that population and cause untoward suffering. You look at sub-Saharan Africa, where vaccination rate is poor, but ironically, the healthcare system is in some ways better than North Korea and more accessible to a lot of people. The median age of sub-Saharan Africa is much less than North Korea, and the ability to interact in open air reduces the possibility of transmission. So in some ways, poorer countries can weather the storm a bit better because of some built-in geographical advantages.
For any of the politicians that are listening, how do we as Canadians, as one of the richer nations in the world, how do we contribute to or affect the distribution of those vaccines? How can we
Right. Help out? So there is an institute set up, the COVAX Institute, run by, I think WHO runs it, where wealthy countries donate vaccine and or money to purchase vaccine, which is then distributed to the rest of the world. And it is woefully underfunded, but that seems to be the best mechanism so far to make sure there's a fair and centralized distribution network. We can donate excess vaccine. We are swimming in vaccine right now. We can also up our production capacity, as we are doing. So Canada we're building vaccine factories again, as we used to have back in the 70s, and for some reason we stopped making them, but we're going to have them again soon. We have homegrown vaccines like the Medicago vaccine, which is based on a tobacco-like plant. I think this technology is amazing. It literally grows on trees. You know,
That's so cool.
Yeah, and if we can flood the world with high-quality, low-cost vaccines, that'll help too. The other things that we can do, or get our politicians to do, is buy and or donate antivirals. So Paxlovid, is the thing that makes the news all the time. What the world is going to see in the next few years is a combination of preventative measures, treatment options, and vaccination for the disease itself. Long COVID, another story entirely. But one way for, like, President Biden is having a summit on what to do about the next steps of COVID. And one of the recommendations put forward in media, I think is a rational one, is to really push this test to treat option for the world. So imagine walking into a pharmacy, you get tested for COVID on the spot. Say, oh, you've got COVID. Here is the antiviral. Take it right now. And don't bother the healthcare system. Don't bother your doctor. Just, you know, go on to life. I think that's a viable outcome. But some steps has to be taken to get there. We have to understand the limitations of the treatment better. We have to make the treatment available to the world and the test available to the world as well.
Yeah, I'm in the north here. We have access to Paxlovid, and the deployment of it has been minimal, to say the least. And a lot of it is access to family doctors and healthcare professionals, and the contraindications, I guess, with other.
That's a huge problem, contraindications. The people who need it the most are the people less able to take it, so because of drug interactions. You need the pharmacological profession to get more deeply involved. Not that they're not involved right now, but they should be the front line. So the pharmacist who gives you the drug has to be the one who checks, oh my goodness, you've got these drugs going on too, you can't take this. And my spouse is a family doctor. She gets endless requests for Paxlovid all the time. The amount of time she spends checking that drug interaction list is debilitating.
Yeah, it'd almost be nice if people had a pre-screen that they could go through.
Yeah, you know, you make a good point. And the larger implication of that point is so much of our, I don't want to say failure, but our struggles in responding to COVID are administrative and infrastructural. Mm-hmm. They're not technological. They're not scientific. Often it's a combination of political will, resources, and administrative burden. And those are the things we can fix.
Exactly. Yes. We see that with our the ease that First Nation governments in the North have been able to implement and respond quickly. It's night and day compared to what the territorial government is able to respond to, because they're a larger bureaucracy. They have more more checks and balances, or more strict rules in place than a First Nation does. Yeah, it definitely becomes an impediment to
you know,
responding
in some ways,
quickly in an emergency. Yeah,
in some ways, our democracy has been our biggest weakness in responding to a pandemic. Our strengths, our values, are our weakness, which is a painful thing to me to say. Western, not speaking obviously about Indigenous communities, but Western nations in general, because of, you know, the supposed liberal mindset, are susceptible to misinformation and disinformation, and this stress on personal freedoms has really impacted our ability to implement large scale public health restrictions. So it's fascinating watching.
Yeah, it's a family who lived in Japan for a long time, and that communal mentality where you have a responsibility, all your actions affect everybody else, is a very different mindset than what we have in North America, where we're talking about infringement and we're seeing protests for infringement of my personal right.
It's amazing, isn't it?
You're making me wear a mask.
Yeah.
How could you?
So this is a cultural issue, not a scientific issue. It's fascinating watching. Yeah. We don't talk enough about Bhutan. Bhutan is a success story beyond all others. And Bhutan, I think their prime minister is a public health professional, or the president is, and they got slow access to vaccination. Everybody understood once it's available, it is our civic responsibility to accept vaccination. It's our civic responsibility to not infect other people. Their first case was an American tourist, I think, who was immediately isolated and vaccinated, and everybody took care of him. You know, it's the mindset that matters, not the technology.
Yeah, I think that's a tweetable moment. maybe switching to kind of what's next. The discussion now is all about endemic. How are we shifting out of pandemic mode into endemic? And what does that actually mean?
What does it mean?
Well,
what is an endemic? An endemic just means that there are no more waves. It means the presence of a disease pretty much consistently in a defined geographic area. My dog's barking, I hope it's not too much of a problem. So you can accept endemicity at an almost unnoticeable level, or you can accept endemicity at a crippling, unsustainable level. So you can think about something like tetanus, which is an endemic disease, a vaccine preventable endemic disease, where no one talks about tetanus. Maybe if you're, you know, if you've fallen down the water slide and cut your foot open, you go to the hospital, ask, have you had your tetanus shot? Well, if not, we'll investigate it now. But that's a level of endemicity that we never think about. It's possible to have endemicity that is crippling to our healthcare system and to our way of life. So what we do now affects the level at which we will settle and accept endemicity, which is why it's frustrating to me to look at doing away of mask mandates and even vaccine mandates before we have pushed the disease to such a low level that we can hold there at our endemic level. So are we at the endemic stage? I don't know. We won't know until months or even years past, until we see whether or not the waves are still happening to a large extent. Yeah. But it looks like politically people want it to happen now, and are assuming it's happening now and declaring it to be endemic, which is not the way this works at all. I mean, a pandemic can be declared for administrative purposes. WHO declares a pandemic when they think, well, now we can mobilize these resources because we called it a pandemic. But a pandemic just means a higher than average rate of new cases in more than one geographical area around the world. It's a vague definition. Mm-hmm. An endemic has a similar vague definition. You can't declare an endemic, though.
I know, it's quite funny to listen to the rhetoric, because we're still in waves in Canada. Like, we're still seeing that, and we're seeing it in regions where it's really affecting our healthcare system. There is small recoveries of, like I'm thinking of British Columbia, where the wait lines are starting to be addressed for elective surgeries. But there's still, like, we've got healthcare system professionals in the Yukon that are burning out. And I think across all of Canada, North America, probably.
That is my biggest concern, and particularly for Indigenous communities where the supply of healthcare workers is poor to begin with. And the labor crisis, we're going to see the sequelae, the implications of this labor crisis for months, if not years to come. Hope it's not generations. But how do you sustain healthcare now, let alone 8 months from now, when people have not gone back to work? You know, it's a challenge. We haven't talked about long COVID yet either. Like, the implications of long COVID. I don't know what the implications are. We're seeing the hepatitis waves happen around the world, and there's a strong suspicion that it might be linked to COVID infection. I think it probably is, frankly, but I'm not a virologist. I can't say for sure. Epidemiologically, there is a statistical link between the two, which is very suggestive, and it seems to be biologically plausible. But if that's the first taste of the long-term implications of mass infection, that's troubling.
Especially when you think of a liver disease such as hepatitis. It could be with you for the rest of your life. And if you're a five-year-old getting that, it's huge. The rest of your life is affected. It limits your choices.
Yeah. And that's just the scientific perspective. The political perspective is even grander. So those who minimized pediatric infection, if in fact the hepatitis is linked to COVID, and I'm not saying it necessarily is, I suspect it probably is, then there is a sunk cost fallacy. We have to maintain this narrative that kids don't get sick, kids don't get seriously sick, when if in fact this is a long-term consequence of it, you can't admit to that fact. So we have a lot of work coming up politically, culturally, scientifically. I don't know where to start. All I know is I'm not going to be unemployed anytime soon. We probably need a royal commission to investigate a number of aspects of the pandemic, including how we responded to it in long-term care centers, in Indigenous communities, in our narrative approach and our communications approach, and how to prepare for the next time. And you asked what we do next, and I do have a more comprehensive, fulsome answer to that. We have to do a lot of things administratively. we got to fix the way public health communicates, not just with the public, but with each other. We have places in this country where you send case reports by fax.
Yes.
You know, 1990s yeah. technology. And no wonder we can't get the COVID app to work if we're using 1990s technology. There's a paper.
Yeah, sorry, some regions have chosen not to use the COVID app. So that's
well, I can't blame them. I can't. Well, yeah. I mean, the COVID app was never expected to be a game changer anyway. I looked at it as a beta test of something that we can put into place for the next pandemic. To see what the uptake would be and the challenges. And I don't want to bore people with technology, but there's a GPS approach and there's a Bluetooth approach. And the GPS approach would allow the app to actually track where you are and figure out who you're in contact with and can manage this stuff through an AI quite effortlessly at low cost.
Yeah.
But it's perceived to be intrusive. Whereas the Bluetooth approach is what we use, is if you walk by someone, it logs the fact that you're walk by them. And if they end up testing positive later on, you'll get an alert later on that you may or may not have to respond to. It's more respectful of the quote unquote freedom priorities.
Privacy, yeah.
Yeah, whereas the GPS approach would probably be a game changer if we were to adopt that. But there's a paper from 2004 that I always cite that talked about the lessons we learned from SARS-1. Mm-hmm. Remember SARS-1? SARS-1 was a low-level multi-nation epidemic of the precursor of this virus that affected cities like Toronto and Hong Kong. And the lessons were three lessons in this paper. First lesson was animal husbandry is bad for human health. That's my vegan propaganda coming up. Put that aside. Number two, which is relevant here, is that the best technologies are the old technologies. So wearing a mask, hiding in your house, staying away from people, that always works. You know, you don't need Paxlovid. You don't need necessarily the vaccine if this other stuff is available to you. And number three was communication is essential. And they were talking mostly about communication between institutions. But what we've learned in this pandemic is how you talk to everybody is essential. And that has been so incredibly broken. And I really hope that we focus the next few years on fixing our ability to engage with the public. And that takes our conversation like right around to the first thing we talked about, which is the cracks in society. And these cracks have been able to be exacerbated because of underlying distrust and mistrust issues. Okay. So we have to fix the trust issues before we can fix the communication issues. In other words, we got to fix everything to fix anything.
Yeah, it's so true. Like being able to, because here in the Yukon, we have had a lot of communications with our communities, our Indigenous communities, our community as a whole. And it takes so many layers. It's on social media, it's repackaging some of those. I think of Dr. Teresa Tam and her interviews. It's repackaging those in the snippets for TikTok or for Instagram, but in a way that gets seen by the target audience, because not everybody's logging in to watch
right like I'm always eager to talk about how to communicate public health. Like I don't know for sure what to do. I have some thoughts on it because I've been doing this last couple of years. I'm not trained in this, frankly. Just something I jumped in knee deep, and I look back at the previous public health campaigns, like what we did around smoking in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and which worked to a large extent, but didn't work to a large extent in some populations. And if you think about the way that the anti-smoking campaign works now is you buy a pack of cigarettes and there's a picture of a diseased lung on it. It's like saying, if you take this, you're going to die. You're going to die. We're not saying you can't do it, but if you do it, you're going to die. So the intent there is to change behavior. Now, I think we're in an era now where there's so much distrust that if it's clear that your intent is to change behavior, a very large segment of the population is going to discount you automatically. So I think our approach has to be transparency in sharing information without necessarily being transparent in our intent to change behavior. Like, here is the efficacy of the vaccine. Here's what will happen if you choose not to vaccinate. You do you. And here's how I got this information. And that's a delicate balance, because if there's the slightest sense that I'm pushing an agenda, doors will be shut in my face. And I don't know how to navigate this new world. This is a bit dangerous. a lot of what we talk about in knowledge translation is here are the different avenues, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, op-ed. But that's the first level of analysis. Beyond that is something mm-hmm. more profound. It's something about identity. It's how yeah. dare I presume to tell you what to do when I don't even know who I am. So you got to start with the internal journey and share outward. So the best communication, I think, is by those who are transparent in their vulnerability and in their identity. So people trust mm-hmm. you more if they know who you are and they know what your weaknesses are and so forth. So I'm off on several tangents there, but as we invest in a new generation of public health communicators, I think that's got to be part of the messaging, is know yourself and be authentic about who you are.
Mm-hmm. And I think because we're having these discussions right now around how do we communicate the risk of the fall flu pandemic, or right now we've got COVID and it's RSV that's hitting RSV. Communities.
Influenza
really.
A apparently is otherwise too. Yeah. Right. Part of that too is also communicating the limitations of science. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that 2 years of self-protection is causing a rebound of extremely high RSV rates? It's possible. I don't know what the mechanism would be necessarily, but we have to be open to that possibility. And so the COVID minimizers was like, you caused this with your lockdowns and your public health. Okay, maybe. But to prevent these accusations, it would have been useful if we had put forth the rationale for recommendations. This is why we think we have to do these things. This is what we know and what we don't know. And science isn't about certainty. Science is, given the information I have now, this is my best recommendation, with the caveat that all this is true until further notice.
Yeah. And I think that's the hardest thing for people to absorb, is this is what we know right now. This is right as of right now. A hard thing to accept, because people want to know the answers going forward.
Exactly.
That crystal ball.
And I think that comes about because of the way we have talked about science in the past, how it's portrayed in the media, the all-knowing mm-hmm. person, you always go to all the answers. No, a scientist is someone who looks for answers and changes their idea as more information comes in. We should have more respect for people who change their minds than less, more respect. The mask thing was a big boondoggle, because so many came out early on saying masks are pointless. Then a week later changed their minds. Like, actually, we're wrong about that. So the vociferousness with which we express these things must be toned down to some extent. And I'm guilty of it as well. I'm a vaccine evangelist. But I have to tone down my rhetoric, understanding that as new variants emerged, the vaccines weren't as effective, or they're doing different things now.
Yeah, they're still pretty effective, though.
So very effective, yes. Very effective to keep you out of the hospital, out of the morgue, to reduce transmission. Yes. They're less effective, but still worthwhile.
And we've got, just this past week, we had the availability of fourth dose for individuals over 50 being allocated here in the Yukon. We've had a very low uptake on the fourth dose in the elderly population. Prior to this, it was only available to 70 plus.
And, do you know what the percentage is?
I didn't check just before. I think close to 30, 27, something like that.
For fourth doses?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but we've also had a lot of COVID in the community. So we don't really know if it's slow uptake because people have just recently contracted COVID mm-hmm. and have to wait the 90 days before they can get their next shot.
It's confusing to me. I don't see, such almost unthinkable downsides to a fourth dose or fifth dose or sixth dose. Even give me as many doses as you want. I see the mm-hmm. upside far outweighs the downside. And yet I get this question every week, should I get a fourth dose? Yeah, you should get a fourth dose. There's no reason not to, frankly.
When we're thinking there's these other variants that are, they're out there. The virus is still mutating. So keeping yourself as highly protected as possible.
The reason is somehow the narrative that the vaccines don't work has made it way out there. And that's being mm-hmm. repeated at a casual, colloquial level. What's the solution? I don't know. I've been talking to so many people about this, how to combat disinformation or misinformation. And at the policy level, targeting the people who create disinformation, that's easy and obvious. There's some countries who are literally creating troll farms specifically to flood this country and our allies with disinformation. But how do you overcome, you know, the guy who's pumping gas next to you, so you're here to the vaccines, you know, give you rabies. I think what we need is trusted figures to speak out publicly on things. And that's the only way forward, because distrust is the fundamental problem here. And you got to find people who are still trustworthy to put forth these messages. Who does that leave? I don't know of any trustworthy people that the nation would embrace. It has to be community by community.
I think so. Yeah. I think it does come down to who are people going to listen to in your community?
Yeah. You said that well. That's exactly it. Who are you going to listen to?
So thinking of that and our First Nation communities, and not just in Yukon, but across Canada, what would be some of the recommendations? I know we talked about masks and distancing, that old technology, but what protective health measures could be put in place or should stay in place?
Good question. Very good question.
As we're going through this.
First, we have to accept that COVID is an airborne disease. People don't know there are different ways of catching a viral respiratory infection. One of them is touching surfaces and having someone else touch that surface and touch their face. We don't think that's a major way that people get COVID anymore. Maybe a handful of people have got it that way, but it's not profoundly important. So washing your groceries, stuff that a lot of us did back in the day, probably not as important. Mm-hmm. Deep cleaning, not as important. Do they get it from droplets? So droplets is when we exhale, and then these large droplets around 5 microns or larger come out of our mouth and nose and fall to the ground within 1 or 2 meters, which is why we have that 2 meter distancing rule. And if you're going to walk within 2 meters, we assume you wear a mask so that if a droplet falls on your face, it's not going to touch your face and be inhaled by you. Airborne transmission is when the droplets are smaller than 5 microns in general, and can linger in the air for hours and sometimes drift for many, many meters. In fact, an infected person go into a room, exhale virus, leave the room, someone else walks into an empty room, inhales it, and gets infected. That's kind of what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
And so how do you control for that kind of transmission? Number one is ventilation. So this is one of the reasons that being outside is so much safer. There's natural ventilation. The wind takes it away. If you can't have natural ventilation, then having windows open and a fan going, that helps. Or good quality filtration systems. So the engineers talk about something called MERV. That's the mechanical something, something, something rating for the filter. Anything 13 and above supposedly is fine to filter out viruses. HEPA is the best quality filter. So hospitals use HEPA filters. You can get a portable HEPA filter for your office or your bedroom and plug it in and it cleans the air. You can make your own HEPA filter device called a Corsi Rosenthal device. Go on YouTube and look up the instruction. You just got to buy a couple of furnace filters and a box fan and tape it together. And that's good enough for like a classroom.
It's like less than 40, 50 bucks to build one of those. It's so awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know why people don't use these. So ventilation is very, very, very important. I think that should be a permanent fixture going forward in public indoor settings. Now, if you want to get fancy, install CO2 monitors to keep track of exactly how much ventilation you're getting. So in general, we're looking at the number of nanometers per meter squared, I think, of CO2. And that tells you how much ventilation is coming in compared to the outside air. For a while though, we talked about plexiglass barriers. I don't recommend that. That was to control for droplet transmission. If you're talking to someone at a ticket counter, your oral spray doesn't get on their face.
Speaking moistly.
Speaking moistly, exactly. That's great for a teller environment, like a grocery store or movie theater. That's great there. But in a place where you're going to be with people for hours on end, it actually is deleterious because it affects the airflow. So you can be trapped in with someone for a long time. An airborne transmission is like smoking a cigarette. That's what aerosols are. So you can visualize someone behind a plexiglass barrier smoking a cigarette, exhaling, and seeing the smoke go over and land on you. So it doesn't
work
that well.
That's such a good visual to have, yeah.
You can also picture someone smoking a cigarette and then leaving the room, you coming in and smelling it and inhaling it that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so plexiglass I don't recommend. Symptom checks, I think, still do a good job. Now, can you get it? Can you transmit it asymptomatically? Absolutely. It's just less likely. If you're symptomatic, you're more likely to have sufficient viral load to be passing on to other people so that they can intake a infectious dose and get infected that way. So if you're an employer, you know, discourage your symptomatic employees from coming in, but also incentivize that by making sure that they get compensated. Right. So I think paid sick leave to be something that every province and territory makes mandatory. Those are my socialist credentials. So disincentivizing people from going to work and going to school while sick is a good idea. If you are sick and have to go somewhere, wear a mask. Not just any mask, wear a respirator. A respirator is a kind of tight-fitting facial mask. N95 is a respirator. KN95 is a respirator. They don't have to be hospital grade. They don't have to be fit tested, some people claim. A fit test is when you pay someone to make sure that this mask is so perfectly sealed around your mouth that nothing gets in or out. That's what doctors and nurses have to do, fit test it. Right. We don't have to do that. Just, you know, getting one on at the local store, KN95 is good enough, because that helps control not just the source, someone exhaling stuff, but also incoming. If you're walking through a cloud of aerosols, you're less likely to be able to inhale that way. I want to say that masks are not perfect defenses. This is one of the pushbacks people always offer. Well, I wore a mask and I got sick. Yeah, it's not perfect. But the probability of you getting sick if everyone around you is wearing a mask is actually quite, quite low. So when we think about mask wearing, we're thinking about who's wearing it, you or the source or both of you, how long you're in their proximity. That's important. If you're wearing a poor quality mask in a room with someone infected with Omicron, for example, you can get infected in a matter of minutes. If you're wearing a high quality mask with that same person, it will take hours to get the same dose. If you sit there for a couple of days, you're going to get infected, even wearing the mask. But you've got hours to go shopping now. So the high quality mask matters. Vaccination is important. Now, anyone listening to this right now is probably pro-vaccination. I understand those who aren't are probably hesitant for a number of reasons. There's some people who can't get vaccinated for a variety of allergic reasons. But if you are eligible, I recommend not only you get vaccinated, you get vaxxed to the max. So two doses for a while was considered fully vaccinated, because two doses was statistically highly likely to keep you out of the hospital, out of the morgue, but also likely to prevent you from getting infected in the first place and prevent you from infecting others. Now, with Omicron, that last part has dwindled significantly. It still keeps you out of the hospital and out of the morgue. It's just you're still going to get it if you're get sufficient infectious dose and maybe passed on to other people, although you won't suffer as much. With three doses, the ability of the vaccine to prevent infection and transmission is restored considerably. With four doses, even more so. So the more boost you get, the better ability you have to avoid infection in the first place, which is what we care, which is useful. At a population level, we care about that because that prevents the penetration of the disease into your community. So talking about communities, if you can't be vaccinated, if you're a child under five, for example, like my kid, I would like that child to only interact with people who are vaccinated, because even though they can still get it, it's just less likely. We're talking here about probabilities. And those are the main reasons, main things, frankly. If you keep an eye on the transmission rates in your community, you can make risk-based choices as well. So if the transmission rate is through the roof, it'll find a way, the disease will find a way through your defenses. If it's moderate rates of transmission, you can be a bit more confident in this, in the risks that you take. So you can, you know, go to that patio party if the rates are under control at the moment. If another factor it's through the roof, I would say I'd stay home until things are under control.
I think our rates have been, because we're not getting everybody tested and we're using a lot of rapid antigens, our rates are still quite high. They had reached like 47% there, but
Yeah, I
it
noticed your
had
test
dropped
positivity
since.
rate was quite high. I think last I checked, UConn is 29% test positivity rate. The national average is 12%. I know, of course, test positivity rate isn't the most perfect measure. It's, for those who don't know, that's the percentage of tests that come back positive. But it gives us a hand-waving argument about how much the disease has penetrated into the community. So it sounds like there's some deep penetration happening. Masking remains, aside from vaccination, masking is your best bet for personal protection when everyone else has made bad choices. So if you wear an N95 or KN95, at least you know, well, I've done my part. And if I walk through this cloud of virus, I have a low probability of receiving infection.
I think one of the other important pieces, even for those that are getting vax to the max, or they've done their second dose, they've got a booster, and they contracted COVID. So UConn, we had several situations of that. The symptoms were so mild that people didn't realize they actually had COVID. But I think that's a testament to the effectiveness of the vaccine.
100%, 100%. If you hadn't got that vaccine, maybe you'd be in a ventilator or dead. I think the expectation of what the vaccine confers is a little bit out of proportion to what they actually do confer. They confer something extraordinary. People are expecting perfection. And it's sufficient if a vaccine just removes symptoms. It's sufficient. We have other vaccines, like the rotavirus vaccine, for example, does not prevent transmission, but it removes symptoms. And as a result, we have almost no cases of rotavirus, or rarely cases of rotavirus, because it's a mandatory vaccine now for kids. So if imagine if everyone was unable to be symptomatically affected, but they still got infected. That's okay. You're much less likely to get long COVID, much less likely to have these other things we talked about. Civilization goes on, your life is not affected. So that's what we care about.
That's like the best outcome.
It's the best, I mean, the best outcome would
Reduced death
be,
rates.
yes, it's zero transmission at all. I think we've done a poor job of explaining vaccine technology to people. And we use the best examples all the time, like smallpox is such a tremendous success story. But most vaccines aren't smallpox vaccines. Most vaccines are, good, but not perfect. The flu vaccine is a good example. A good year of flu vaccine gives you a 40% efficacy, which doesn't sound like a lot. It's enough to prevent enormous amounts of mass death. And as a result, I encourage everyone to get the flu vaccine as well. The downside is minuscule, the upside is profound. But vaccines will not give you perfect protection. They are one of a number of strategies we use to control infection in a population. We talked about the other ones already.
Yeah, and I just want to put out there, because I hear this a lot, that I'm going to get COVID from the vaccine, or I'm going to get the flu from a flu vaccine.
Right. So that's impossible. Here's why it's impossible. We talked about the Chinese vaccine earlier. One of the Chinese vaccines is an inactivated virus, which means it's the actual virus they're injecting you with. That's not what we use. The mRNA vaccine doesn't contain anything living at all. It's literally a molecule, it's an instruction for your body to produce something that isn't also living. It is to produce antibodies. So at no point are you exposed to the virus from a vaccine. The flu vaccine, same thing. They're just antigens. So that was the case many, 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 many decades ago. And this is why these stories persist. But that's no longer the case. We solved that problem decades ago.
Thank goodness. Because
I
getting
mean, there's
injected with live vaccine does not sound good.
Right. I mean, we do have live vaccines still for some diseases, like rabies, for example, but that's not what we're talking about here. Hang on, I might be wrong about that. Rabies might be immunoglobulin. but but I think there's some other vaccines with the saliva vaccines, but this is not one of them.
Okay. I think we've talked about this concern about long COVID. Did you want to address anything else? Do you think our healthcare system's ready for it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, we don't define it well. Most of the studies say long COVID is symptoms lasting more than X number of weeks. And symptoms can be anything from, you know, sniffles to diarrhea to, you know, being on a ventilator. I've had students who are in their 20s who are, you froze there for a second. Okay. I've had students who are in their 20s who are nationally ranked athletes who got COVID 2 years ago who can't climb the stairs today.
Wow.
So there are exceptions, but it does happen. So that's what we're scared of. We're scared about that. We're scared about the long-term brain fog. We're scared about the inflammatory issues having to do with these organs like the liver. Is it common? I don't know. Depends on what study you look at. But the question is our healthcare system ready for it? No, we are not ready for it. We are not ready for it at all. And this is going to be possibly one of the largest challenges to our healthcare system over the next decade, unless we figure out how to treat this and prevent it pretty soon. I think we will figure things out within the next 2 years or so. A lot of work is being done on this. And there is a strong suspicion that vaccination greatly reduces A, the probability of long COVID, and B, the intensity of long COVID when it does happen. So vaccination remains a great option here. And again, the downside of vaccination, we've given hundreds of millions of doses, hundreds of millions, if not billions of doses around the world. And the statistical signal for anything bad happening has not appeared yet. Yeah, there've been a handful of cases of some bad things, you know, but they're so extraordinarily rare that it's not worth worrying about if you're not someone with a pre-existing susceptibility to vaccination issues. But the long COVID thing is troubling, and it's particularly troubling amongst children to me because we don't study it enough. And this narrative around children being superhuman when it comes to this disease is, I think, preventing some of the studies from taking place, because often we don't know when children got infected.
Because if they go to daycare, they have the sniffles a lot.
Yeah.
I've got little nieces and they get the sniffles.
Yeah, like my kid just turned two and every sniffle I thought looked kind of funny. Is it COVID? And how do you swab a two-year-old? It's kind of hard. And also, testing for the antibodies is challenging too, because after a number of weeks, the antibodies may not turn up on a typical antibody assay. It doesn't mean that person was never infected. It just means you missed that window when the infection was detectable. So all kinds of technical challenges here. We can talk a bit about rapid tests as well. I mean, rapid tests, I'm a big believer in rapid tests, love them a lot, but they have limitations. People have to understand when and how to use them. Rapid tests don't detect the same thing as the PCR tests. The PCR tests detect the presence of the genetic material of the virus to an extraordinary amount of sensitivity. So maybe you were infected weeks ago, but you've recovered, but there's still some residue left. The PCR test will detect that. Or maybe you just got infected this morning and you're not producing anything bad yet. The PCR test will render a positive result and you only get seriously sick 2 days from now. That's useful. The rapid antigen test detects something different. It detects a protein on the surface of the virus that must be in sufficient quantity to trigger a rapid test. So you could test positive on a PCR, but negative on a rapid test until you develop sufficient viral load to test positive on a rapid test. That disconnect is why many people claim that rapid tests aren't as sensitive as they need to be. I disagree. Rapid tests are sensitive when they need to be sensitive. If you test positive on a rapid test, you've got so much viral load, you are a threat to other people. So stay home. If you test negative on a rapid test, there's a very strong possibility that you still have the virus, but you're not yet a threat to others. So you might be safer to do things. And one way to reduce that uncertainty is to test again the next day and test again the day after that. So the more we test, we call that serial testing, the probability of failure reduces. So rapid testing comes down to how you use the test and how you interpret the results. They're not the same as PCR.
And I have to give kudos to the leadership and First Nation communities here in the Yukon, where we've implemented and broadly distributed rapid antigen tests and the rapid molecular, so the Lucira devices.
Oh, fantastic. As well. That's great.
And using the Lucira as a verifier. And we've also adopted the throat and nose swabbing technique, because we were finding with Omicron that it detected the virus load much sooner than just the nasal. Yeah.
Throw in a rectal swab, you're good to go. Just make sure the order that you do it is. Yeah.
Throat, nose first.
I do want to say something about vaccination and rapid testing is a little concerning as well. Not concerning, but confusing. Michael Mina, who one of the great champions of rapid testing, brought this to public awareness some weeks ago, tweeting about it. So if you're vaccinated, one of the things that vaccination does, it produces a symptomatic response very early in the infection scenario. So if you're unvaccinated, your system is primed to go to war. So suddenly it sees the virus in your body. I'm going to get that virus, and starts throwing all kinds of stuff at it, the sniffles, the coughing, all that stuff. So you got symptoms, but you don't have a lot of viral load yet. So if you give yourself a rapid test when you got symptoms and you've been vaccinated, you probably test negative because your body is just overreacting to the presence of that virus. If you test a day or two later, maybe then you'll test positive. On the other hand, if you are not vaccinated and you got symptoms, you will test positive on a rapid test, probably, because it takes a while to get a response from your body based upon viral load. So all it means is the vaccines work, but it confuses the rapid test a little bit. As a result, if you have symptoms, test now, test again tomorrow. And in that time period, don't expose yourself to people.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important, because we had seen that as well throughout this spike that we have in the Yukon with the Omicron variant. Just before we wrap up, I wanted to talk a little bit about your research and how your research prior to the pandemic was about how public health integrates non-standard data points into understanding disease epidemiology. What have you learned or observed during this this two-year exercise about that?
Oh, that's a pretty interesting and broad question. So a lot of my research prior to COVID was on using non-traditional data to make insights into disease, like administrative data, for example. With COVID, that's been a critical kind of approach, because we've had to throw so many different kinds of data sets into understanding things. Excess deaths, for example, became critical in understanding the true impact of COVID, especially in places where policy was different. There's a new study out right now looking at global excess deaths due to COVID. It's controversial. It found that the German excess deaths were way greater than the UK excess deaths, but that's probably wrong, because just that previous year, Germany had very, very low number of deaths. And so that there's an artificial sense of increase in deaths. They probably did Sweden wrong, because Sweden had a lot more excess deaths than we think. The use of wastewater has been triumphant. So that's an untraditional, but now going to be probably a permanent fixture in our public health infrastructure. So if you don't know, wastewater is essentially sewage. People poop into the sewage system, and we test the water to see what they're pooping out, because COVID does appear in feces. And that's done by comparing the concentration of the viral signal to the concentration of an inane virus that's there all the time. So you account then for dilution effects of rainfall and things like that. That's been profoundly important, especially as our testing has diminished. Wastewater becomes more and more important. As an aside, I'll say one of the ways we track the presence of COVID now, because we can't really test that much, is wastewater and sentinel surveillance, which is when we use certain key places in the community, like hospitals, to test everybody, and test positivity rate. You use all that together to model, to get a sense of how things are coming up and down. Looking at hospital rates has been very important. So hospitalization rates has been a key metric for understanding not just the impact of the disease on our community, but also how present it is. If you don't know what the testing is like, well, you can get a sense of it based upon who's coming through the hospital doors. Same with the school situation, any school surveillance that's reported, we get a sense of that. The challenge with the hospitalization these days, I'm off on a tangent here, I think, but is in incidental COVID versus causal COVID. And this is something the minimizers always point to, is how many of the people that you count as being hospitalized with COVID were just hospitalized with a broken leg and they happened to test positive and they're asymptomatic, so who cares? Yeah, that's a real thing. First of all, nobody gets hospitalized with a broken leg. If you're in the hospital, you're there for a serious reason. But two points there. First is that modelers suggest that with Omicron being so present, probably anywhere from 30% to 50%, possibly more, is causal. So don't overly minimize the incidental COVID. Number two is, even if you didn't come in for COVID, you got COVID now. And as a result, the hospital has to spend resources on you. You have to put you in isolation ward. Everyone's got to wear masks. We got to test all the people around you. So you're costing money and time. Number three is, even though you didn't come in for COVID, the COVID is going to exacerbate your condition. So if you came in for, you know, kidney disease or some sort of diabetes complication or heart disease, the COVID is going to make it worse and possibly push you towards death. So incidental is not necessarily incidental. So that's how the complicated aspects of administrative data work. Next thing is, I wrote a paper early in the pandemic asking for a dedicated approach to data collection at the hospital level so that we can build epidemiological models for causal factors. Who is most likely to get sick? We still don't know. We get a sense that if you've got certain preconditions, if you're obese and older, sure. But is a vitamin D deficiency really profoundly predictive of a bad outcome? I don't know. How about other micronutrient deficiencies? How about a history of taking this kind of medication versus that kind of medication? If we were to create a database of patient charts with the key variables inputted that we can just crunch electronically to produce the regression models to just get a sense of which of these factors is statistically more likely to result in a bad outcome, I think that would have been profoundly useful. And a rational data infrastructure health society would have done this within the first 3 months. We didn't. We could even get a database for vaccine uptake, for goodness. So I'm not surprised.
It's really frustrating. That is honestly one of the biggest challenges that we're facing here in the Yukon is access to data, collection of data.
It's astounding. 2022, we can't do this.
Shocking. I know. Almost everyone has a smartphone.
I know, right? Yeah. Well, part of the problem is most of our IT focus and data and money and expertise in the world is focused on getting people to look at their phone longer. It's not meant to actually solve problems.
We need a different algorithm there. I'm glad you're talking about wastewater. That's our kind of next step looking forward. And for us in the Yukon, a lot of Indigenous populations eat traditional food, so harvest off the land. And we know that there is that transmission between ungulate species or animal species and wastewater, if you think sewage lagoons. Yeah. So I think that's going to be our next step after we get our wastewater surveillance testing program up, is testing our animal species.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. The zoonotic aspects of COVID, I think, are largely unknown and probably don't really contribute a great amount to transmission, but it must be monitored, especially if it may lead to more mutation later on. Like, people need to know, why is the flu such a big deal every year? The flu is a big deal because it comes out of porcine and avian species, birds and pigs. And when they're infected together, they tend to share DNA or RNA and create superbugs that can then infect people and create all kinds of havoc. So imagine you're in an Asian wet market and there's a sick duck in a cage next to a sick pig, and they both have different kinds of flu. Now suddenly one flu jumps over into the other animal and says, hey, I got this I got this DNA here for humans. You want it? Sure, I'll take it. And suddenly we have this super bug that's infecting people and creating a pandemic. We don't want that to happen to COVID. It's probably how COVID arose in the first place. I don't know for sure, but it's probably how it did. We think it was via a pangolin and maybe some other, a bat perhaps. But if we have infected ungulates, other kinds of domesticated animals, is it possible that they will communicate with other viruses and create other kinds of strains later on? I suppose so. I'm not a virologist, I can't say for sure. That's one reason to keep track. Another reason is we want a healthy domestic animal population. Another reason is we don't want to have infection pinging between different species too often. I'm often asked, can we eradicate COVID? No, we can't. And this is relevant to what we talked about here for a second, so bear with me. So there are different ways, different outcomes for respiratory viruses like this. We can make them extinct, eradicate them, eliminate them, or control them. So extinction is we wipe it off the face of the earth. We've never done that. Number two is we eradicate it, meaning we wipe it off the face of the earth, but keep samples for some reason. We've done that twice, smallpox and rinderpest. Three is elimination. That's where we drive it outside our borders. We do this a lot. Rabies in England, polio in many countries, and inch towards eradication. And the last is control. That's where we tolerate its existence, but we have public health strategies to keep it under control. The reason that eradication is off the table, probably, is we need some things for eradication to happen. We need a vaccine that is highly tolerated, that you vaccinate for life, and that renders lifetime immunity. We need the disease to be, once you're infected, you get immunity for life. That's not happening here. You need a vaccine that is tolerable throughout all age groups. We haven't got that yet. It's useful if infection leaves a mark of some kind, so you know you've been infected. So smallpox has all of the above. And critically, we need no animal reservoirs. So a reservoir is where the disease lives in its spare time. So smallpox lives in people. So if you eliminate in people, it's not going to wait out there in a deer mouse or in a moose or something.
Yeah.
COVID, cats, dogs, zoo animals, ungulates, etc. It lives in a lot of species. So if we got all of the above, if we got the perfect vaccine, we'd have to vaccinate every species of mammal on the planet. So we can't do it.
Not going to happen. Dang it. Well, I don't know if you want to say any last words.
Yeah, I do. I mean, we've talked a lot of negative stuff today, but it's a lot of positive news too. So much good news. We got vaccines. Oh my goodness, that's enormous. Yay! That's enormous.
And the best ones.
And they're getting better, by the way. We're going to have an intranasal vaccine, which will really control transmission well. We're probably going to have a pan-coronavirus vaccine at some point, which means good for all variants, present and future. You know, I think these things are possible. Again, I'm not a vaccinologist, but this is what people tell me. Two, we're building up our vaccine infrastructure. So no more waiting for doses. We're going to make them here in Canada and spread them around the country and hopefully vaccinate the world. So we'll have this under control. Three, we're getting more treatment options every day. They're all being tested. There's a huge incentive for them. The reason we got vaccines so fast are administrative reasons. I won't go into which ones they were, but they're all administrative, weren't scientific. If that same administrative approach is taken towards creating treatments, as I think they are, we'll get many more treatments coming very, very soon. Next, we have a better grasp of what the disease is doing. Not perfectly, but a better grasp. And as a result, we can control it more. And four, there's a lot of population immunity right now. So fewer and fewer people are getting seriously sick. That's good news. And five, this has never been an apocalyptic event. There is Russian flu or Asiatic flu back in 1890, I think it was. That was one of the most fatal flus ever. We're not sure which pathogen caused it. Some people think it was a coronavirus, OC43. Don't look that up. I think it's OC43. And the reason they think that is one of the symptoms of Asiatic flu is loss of taste, which is what.
Okay.
The thing about OC43, even though it might have been the cause of this horrible pandemic in the late 1800s, today it's one of the causes of the common cold. So sufficient amount of population immunity has built up such that the disease is not something we think about enough. Now, what this means is it's possible that this disease is just a new common cold entering the human experience. It'll take a while for it to reach that status, and newborn babies will always be a little bit susceptible unless their mothers give them antibodies. You know? But this, again, is not an extinction-level event. It's just something that's got to get used to for a while.
Just a little while. This is just a blip in history, right?
I think so. I think so.
And if we all work together, we'll come out of
that is the lesson relatively here. This is a test of our will and our ability to sacrifice for each other for a short period of time. We fail that test, but we know now what the test is. And when the next exam comes about, we got a cheat sheet.
So thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise and all of your knowledge. I really appreciate it. And this will be posted soon.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.